Buster Keaton did a lot of stunts in his life, and some are hard to watch because you know this was before fancy effects or stunt doubles, so climbing down the drainpipe of a skyscraper or running on top of a speeding train meant you might be seeing something real. And Keaton didn't just perform these acrobatics. For years, he directed them, he staged them, he choreographed the action and edited the film. Though he never took the credit, those brilliant movies were his vision. He was in control. In 1927, Keaton and his crew had worked up a huge set piece, a visual gag that required planning and precision. It was for the movie Steamboat Bill Jr. The film critic Dana Stevens says in a new book that it may just be Keaton's most mature work, but it would also turn out to be his last independent production. The movie business was changing, and even though he was only 32, Buster Keaton's career had hit its peak and was about to drop. We spoke with Dana Stevens in January.
Steamboat Bill Jr. is the last film made by the Buster Keaton Studio, his own production company. But he didn't know when he started shooting that that would be the case. And if people know one Keaton stunt, it's probably this one, even if they've never seen the movie it comes from. In the midst of a hurricane, he is standing in front of a two-story house, and the entire house front collapses on him, leaving him framed in one small window in the attic so that he manages to survive. The filming of this scene turns out to be this almost poetic moment in which several different stories of Buster Keaton's life are converging. It was Labor Day weekend of 1927. That scene was set to be filmed. There had been an enormous amount of prep and design that went into making that scene possible. Keaton's longtime production designer, Fred Gabori, helped create this house so that it would look good on camera, that you wouldn't see the sort of ropes that were holding the whole thing together, so that it would fall in just such a way as to not crush Buster Keaton. It was a 2-ton house front, so, you know, it was a potentially fatal stunt. As Keaton tells it, it was the day before this stunt was to be filmed that his producer and patron and brother-in-law takes him aside and says, look, the film business is changing. The studio system is starting to take over for these independent production companies like the one that I've been running for you for the past decade. And you're going to have to sign on with MGM. He was about to lose all of his creative independence and become a contract player at a big studio. So he steps onto the set that day to film the falling house front. There are 6 different wind machines that are strong enough to turn airplane propellers. That's how strong the wind was to create the effect of a hurricane. Deafening noise. The only way that Keaton knows where to stand in this very small window frame that is going to frame him when the house falls is because there's 2 nails driven into the ground where he's supposed to put his heels. The legend about this day, which was actually later confirmed by the cinematographer and Keaton's co-director, is that the cameraman had to look away because he was so afraid he was going to be witnessing Keaton being crushed. The director was off in his tent praying for the good outcome of the stunt. And as Keaton's widow, Eleanor Keaton, described it many years later after he was already gone, the way that he felt at that moment was that he really didn't care if the house crushed him. He was about to lose the only thing that mattered to him, his creative independence. If you watch that movie knowing something about his life at that moment and what was to happen subsequently in his life, it's so much richer and so much sadder to see just the brilliant achievement that Steamboat Bill Jr. is. It's not just the collapsing house front. That's just one part of this extraordinary sequence at the end where buildings are flying and falling into rivers. A whirlwind picks him up on a tree and drops him into a river. The things that he was able to conceive and to execute with his own company were so magnificent by that point. The idea that that was the moment, just as he was sort of coming into his prime as a filmmaker, that it was all about to be taken away, is just tragic.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Dana Stevens is joining us to talk about her new book, where she explores Buster Keaton's life by framing it against the backdrop of his time. when every part of American life was transforming and the dawn of cinema would change everything. Her book is called Cameraman. Dana Stevens is the film critic for Slate, co-host of the Slate podcast Culture Gabfest. And she told us she was almost 30 before she ever saw a Buster Keaton movie. She was studying in France the same year Keaton would have turned 100.
The French loved them some Keaton. They curated an incredible festival that showed all of his silent movies, the shorts and the features, some of them several times. And it so happened that I had a student card that got me in for practically nothing. And the theater was really near me. And I just went to every movie and went back to several movies and just found myself utterly mesmerized by this figure and wanted to know, who is this person? How can his body do these things? How can he think up these gags and stunts and also be directing it at the same time? And as it happened, because the French are the French and they love their Keaton and their film and their books, there was a little library connected to the Cinémathèque. And so I went and started reading everything they had on Keaton, which was mainly American biographies translated into French. That's sort of how I first started reading about him. And just found that, you know, the minute you start reading about his life story, and I know many other Keaton fans who have had the same experience, you get kind of addicted because you're reading about everything. You know, you're reading about vaudeville, where he was a child star for 17 years before he ever started in movies. And you're reading about the shift from stage entertainment to filmed entertainment. And, you know, you're reading about the shift from silent to sound. And then later in his career, you're reading about the beginning of television and, you know, about the European circus, which he performed in the 50s and 40s, and just almost every part of the history of American entertainment and really American technology and American history and culture in the 20th century intersects in some way with his life. And so the more I read, the more fascinated I got with making those connections.
Well, that's the thing that I think is original about the way you treat Buster Keaton is it's not just Keaton and his life, but it's in the context of the time. Say a little bit more about why the two are important to you. Why did understanding where he fit in time make all the difference for you in some way?
That's such a good question. Time is a big part of the book, and specifically his lifetime. And a way that I would pitch this book in an elevator pitch when people would ask me as I was writing it what it was about would be to say it's not a biography, which is still how I feel about it. Well, although I realize it's shelved as a biography, and it's fine if people buy it because they want to read a biography. They will learn some things about his life. But it is not meant to be a comprehensive biography. It's meant to be a cultural history of his lifespan. And these years in particular, 1895, the year of his birth, and 1966, the year of his death, I just became fascinated by that span of time in American history. Because if you think about it, it's not a very long span. It's 70 years, right? It's the biblical 70. It's not an incredibly long life. But think about how American culture and history and world culture and history changed between 1895 and 1966, right? I mean, someone who was born, you know, with his parents in a traveling show that at times traveled by horse and wagon and sometimes by railroad, which also existed by then. But I mean, it was still really the technology of gaslit stages, horse and wagon, right? And then he dies in 1966 at the height of the space age when we're about to go to the moon. It just seemed really extraordinary that there was somebody who had been living and working and producing, you know, cultural work of all kinds over that 70-year span. And it could be the case that, you know, you could take any artist's life or any person's life and find all those connections within it. But Keaton in particular had this almost Zelig-like way of crossing with just so many, you know, famous individuals of his time and important cultural trends of his time that there just seemed to be an infinite amount there, including lots of things I wish I could have gotten into that I didn't.
There's a poem you wrote to Buster Keaton. You confess it's not maybe the greatest thing in the world, but there is contained in it this central idea, you say, for the book. I wonder, do you mind maybe reading it, or at least let's talk about it?
Well, Doug, actually, I take umbrage at one thing you said. I do still like this poem. And that's what I say in the intro, which is that I know we're supposed to be afraid of the poems that we write as youths. Right. But in fact, I was 30 when I wrote this poem, and I still stand by it. All right, so it's going to make me self-conscious, but I shall read it. Ever wester, ever faster, Buster, hasten your disaster. Scale the mast and list to keening. Buster, listen, are you dreaming? Are you falling? Are you flying? Buster, cinema is dying. Film is falling, time a twister, sound unfurling her nor'easter. Not a whisper, never laughter. Buster, thank you for disaster.
So it's all there, right? I mean, the image I'm seeing of Buster as a projectile, something you see happening in every Buster Keaton movie. And this seems to be important, the sensation that he wants to get the audience to feel this sensation, laughing, but also gasping, because what he's doing is extraordinary and maybe even dangerous.
Right. I mean, the projectile image really initially comes from the three Keatons, the vaudeville act that he grew up in with his parents, which essentially, as far as you can tell from latter-day descriptions of the act or his memory of it, because there's no film of the three Keatons, consisted of him being thrown by his father, right? I mean, he was a little kid when the act got started, or started incorporating him when he had just turned five. And the basic gag was that his father would pick him up to punish him for whatever mischief he was performing on stage and hurl him around, throw him into the backdrop, throw him into the back of the stage, throw him into the wings, throw him into the audience. At one point, there were two audience members. I think Keaton was 8 or 10 at this point. Two audience members who were heckling Myra Keaton, his mother, who was playing saxophone at the front of the stage, which is her role in the act, to play saxophone in a beautiful outfit and ignore the melee going on behind her. And some hecklers made fun of her saxophone playing. Ah, she's no good. And her husband, infuriated, hurled their son out at these two guys and broke one of their ribs, and I think broke the other one's nose or something. I mean, it was known as the most violent act on the vaudeville stage, and, you know, a child was its centerpiece. So that image of him being hurled has to do with, you know, the childhood act, but also with the velocity of his fame, and, you know, and just the fact that from the moment he stepped first on stage with his parents, which seems to be in 1900 when he had just turned five, until sort of the coming of sound and the end of his silent film career, was just one unending upward trajectory for him, right? I mean, he was a huge hit on the stage. And then the moment he moved into film at age 21, he seemed to be comfortable with that new medium and to be doing really interesting things there.
You say the Keatons were not just funny, they were thrilling. And one of the things you mentioned in the book is how you have this kind of desperate desire to want to know what their act looked like and sounded like and how they moved, and that you wanted to not just see it on film somehow, but kind of, I don't know, impossibly, you know, go back in time and see it in person. Say something about that, because it seems like you say in the book that you wanted to sort of see it live in person, as you put it, preferably before there was any foreknowledge of what you were going to see. I mean, like, talk about what you're getting at there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's every researcher, especially if you're researching something like theater history that's ephemeral and only exists in descriptions. Every archivist or historian is really trying to time travel in that way, I think. And so in reading about that act, and especially in trying to picture it in the context of its time, you know, not just excerpted for us to see as if it were a YouTube clip, but really seeing what a whole vaudeville show was like, right? What the acts that before them, the acts after them, you know, as you're researching these vaudeville bills, you'll see, oh, they're performing with, you know, Professor So-and-so and his talking monkeys or whatever these crazy acts were that appeared on the bill with them. Plus films. Also, there'd be very early films when he was a child that would be a part of the vaudeville show, kind of the new novelty technology being displayed at the end of the show. To be able to see the three Keatons in that context would bring a whole new level of understanding to what he did much later, right? So yeah, there's a melancholy to the fact that you can't go back and see exactly what it was really like.
What was Buster's role? I mean, for child performers, I guess there were stock characters. He talked a bit about this. What was the part he sort of settled into, the role he settled into?
I mean, I think he kind of invented his own role. As he talked about it, you know, child performers and family acts were a huge thing at that era. But there was something about his character that was different, that was not as much of a stock character, which I think probably accounted for some of the appeal of it. I mean, some of it, of course, was the violence that we were talking about, that the thrills and laughs went together with the three Keatons act. But also, I think the character he played in a way was himself. He played a real little boy, you know, who was mischievous and who had that kind of, you know, somber reaction to being thrown that people found so funny that then he continued to incorporate into his film persona. And he wasn't cute. He wasn't on stage to be a little Lord Fauntleroy, which he actually played in a stock company for one season and was miserable doing while his mother was having his little sister. So he wasn't that kind of a stock character. He was not part of, you know, the family act where the children dance in a row and have been sort of trained by their father. There was an act called The Seven Little Foys that was a big hit at roughly the same time that had more to do with that, you know, that was a little more of a Brady Bunch vibe. But when it came to the three Keatons, it was really the little boy's comic invention and his ideas that started to drive the act very early. And you see that in the coverage of the act, right? That people writing about it will say, little Buster Keaton is always bringing new things to the stage. And something that a lot of vaudeville acts used to do was, of course, set up an act for the season and just perform it at every venue they went to, because people in a new town are not going to know that you've already done it in 10 other towns on the circuit. But the Keatons were known for being more inventive and spontaneous than that, that they had this one stock thing they would do, right, which is that Keaton would throw his son around in some way. But the actual choreography of it and the improvisation would change from night to night. And I think that was part of what excited people about their act, too.
What was Buster's talent? Like, what was the gift? Was it gymnastics? Was it, and as far as we can tell, was it also in his facial expressions? Was there a kind of fluidity? Was there kind, like, what was the gift there that he possessed?
Yeah, I mean, the way he describes it, I think, is that the unsmiling persona evolved in conjunction with his dad, that the two of them in the process of working on this act together and, you know, creating new ways to hurl him around the stage or to stage this moment of mischief where his dad gets mad at him, you know, and punishes him in some way on the stage. They sort of discovered that when he kept a straight face, it got a bigger laugh. I think when he was a very small child, he's described sometimes as grinning, you know, that he would do an act and then come out of it smiling, and people would be relieved that this little boy was not hurt, and then they would laugh for that reason. But then slowly they started to realize that when he had this poker-faced reaction, it got an even bigger laugh. And he describes his father, Joe Keaton, hissing at him, face, face. That's what his father would say, meaning, you know, make a blank face and they'll laugh more. But you also see a different Keaton in some of the descriptions of Kid Buster than you see on the screen, because he had a lot of verbal comedy he would do. He sang songs, parody songs sometimes of other performers. He was known for his imitations of other vaudeville performers, right? So a little kid putting on the airs of some adult performer that would be well known and recognizable. And a lot of write-ups of those early acts will say things like, you know, his impression of Jack Norworth, who was a comedian on the vaudeville circuit, is, you know, remarkable. And something that's really noticeable, and I try to round this up in the chapters on his performance as a child, is that lots and lots of critics seem to note that there was something unusual about him as a performer. And they wouldn't just praise him and say, he's funny and go see this act, it's funny. They would say things like, I know one of them said, though he's a child performer, you know, of exceptional gifts, he does not appear to have been trained. You know, he had a kind of natural quality as a performer where he seemed to be enjoying the performance and did not seem to be somebody whose parents were slotting him into a role. And I think that must also have accounted for some of the appeal.
Let's talk about how the act breaks up. You mentioned in the book how Buster, he gets into his teens, he starts to get tired of the routine. And then, of course, his father had become, as you write about, more aggressive. He would drink off stage. Talk about how this starts to break down now.
Yeah, the years are hard to pin down. It seems like relatively few years that it was really this bad. But at some point in Buster's teens, a combination of things happens. He gets too big to throw, so they have to change the tenor of the act in some way. And, you know, I think they invented some things that worked really well. They had a famous broom act, a kind of broom battle that you also see reenacted in some Keaton films. And, you know, all kinds of bits of business with the stage. But they couldn't really do the hurling stuff anymore. And the other main thing that changed is that Joe's alcoholism got much worse. I mean, Joe was always a big drinker. Drinking was, of course, a part of vaudeville culture and Keaton's family culture. But I think Joe's drinking started to become more of a problem in those years. And as Buster himself tells the story, even though he was not much of a self-discloser and was extremely protective of his father, he does tell the story that in this period, Joe Keaton Sr. would sometimes get angry about things off stage and then take out his anger on Buster on stage, and also that Myra, his mother, was being abused by his father. So it seems like this was a really dark period for the family. And there's a story that I tell about really the event that started the cascade of problems that made them leave vaudeville, which was that in this period, this dark period for Joe Keaton, which seems to have been also about, you know, resisting growing older and resisting the act changing and his life changing and the world changing in ways that he was not ready for, that he went on this rampage in Providence, Rhode Island, in a theater where they were booked to do a show.
Trashes the place.
Because, yes, he broke all of the furniture that belonged to this theater because the theater manager was angry, I guess, that the Keatons had broken some chairs in the course of doing their act and said, you have to replace these chairs. At this point, that would have been no problem for them. They were a very successful act. But instead, Joe Keaton got furious and proceeded to trash the entire lot of stage furniture that this Providence Theater possessed and, you know, got obviously a bad reputation because of that. The reputation preceded them to their next gig. And all of this culminates, and you can read about some of the details in between in the book, in Joe Keaton being abandoned at a stage door in, I think it was a Los Angeles theater, while his wife and his son took off without him, without even leaving a note, you know, left him there with his trunk and took a train across the country. He did eventually, to some degree, reunite with the family. He never lived as husband and wife with Myra again, but, you know, Buster did take him back into his life. But yeah, that was a very dramatic moment where the act broke up and Buster knew that he was going to have to reinvent himself in some way. Yeah. And in a way that would allow him to continue to support both his parents and his siblings into the future.
But it's interesting as he's trying to sort of craft a life now as a solo performer, there's this element of passivity that you write about. As you put it in the book, you say in the course of a life marked by passivity, both in personal and business relationships, Buster would be faced with a few such decisive moments, and often he would leave the decision-making to someone else. That was an interesting part of his character that you write about. Say something about that, the fact that he was passive in some of these moments.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at almost all of these big crucial moments of his life, including that moment of abandoning his dad and setting off with his mom on a train to, you know, to restart a different kind of life as a performer, it was really because Myra, his mother, asked him to. Uh-huh. You know, she said, "Buster, I can't take it anymore." And then he realized that he had to leave. And so you see that in his personal life. Oh, you see that also when his first marriage breaks up with Natalie Talmadge, who he married in 1921. By 1932, she had sued him for divorce. And, you know, delivered these papers to him. And at that point, you know, he's a rich movie star with a huge mansion in Beverly Hills and a yacht and all kinds of property. And he just ignored the divorce papers completely. He never signed them. He never addressed them. I think his whole life, and this, I think, feeds into the drinking problem that he himself developed in middle age. His whole life, he turned away from conflict. He really could not stand interpersonal or business conflict. And the worst, I think, that ever served him was, you know, this moment in 1927 that we mentioned when he signs the contract with MGM. Right. He didn't really have that much of a choice. Mm-hmm. He wasn't really a free agent at that point because the studio system was kind of closing in on everyone. But yeah, it seems like when you read that about that moment, you just wish so much that he had figured out a way to put up a fight. He figured out a way to do something different, you know, but there was something about him that couldn't quite get there.
Dana Stevens, she's Slate's film critic and co-host of the podcast Culture Gabfest. Her new book is Cameraman, Buster Keaton, The Dawn of Cinema and the Invention of the 20th Century. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Thanks to KUER's mobile app, you can keep NPR Utah as your essential connection wherever you go. Our free mobile app keeps you informed with the latest local stories from KUER News. Explore on-demand podcasts like Radio West, State Street, and Sent Away. Or enjoy nonstop streams of our daily programming, BBC World Service, and classical KUER. Stay connected to your member station with the KUER mobile app, available for free wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the film critic Dana Stevens. We're talking about her new book, which explores the creative genius of Buster Keaton. He began as the child star of his family's vaudeville act and would go on to mastermind some of the greatest silent comedies of all time. Stevens writes about Keaton in the context of his time, when the dawn of cinema was profoundly reshaping a world already in transition. Her book is called Cameraman. Let's talk about 1917 when Buster meets Roscoe Arbuckle. And this really, as you say in the book, it begins his life in film. And this is this period from 1917 to 1929. And I wanted to ask you about this part of the book because you say this part was in some ways the most exciting but the most daunting to write about. Before, as you say, you know, you're writing about his childhood on the stage and some of those vaudeville acts, but you're a cultural historian there because there's no documentation of it. There's no film, I guess, of it. But then he starts making films, and that changes things. For you, as you're thinking about this, it puts you in sort of a different role as a now you're something different. Talk a little bit about that because it was an interesting part of the book, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, you would think that would be the easier part of the book because I'm a film critic by trade, right? And now suddenly there are films to write about beginning in 1917. But I guess what I mean by saying that that's the most daunting part of the book is that not only are you writing as a film critic and writing about, you know, some of the most written about films ever made, yeah. It's not like this is an undercovered person in cinema history, but you're also trying to place them in a cultural context, right? So when I was writing about his childhood, I didn't have the actual footage to look at. I had to look at the reconstructions. But in a way, yes, I was writing cultural history. In that second part of the book, which is called Flying, which is about, you know, the period when the projectile was in full flight and making the movies that he wanted to make, I felt like I wanted to do justice to the incredible films that he was making, but not suddenly just have it be a book about film history. I wanted to keep placing those films in the context of the film industry at large, really. That's kind of the theme of that section outside of Keaton's life, which is what was happening to film in those years between 1917 and 1928 or so, you know, when he has his creative independence, because film itself was changing so much during that time. The film industry, the technology of film, and the audiences of film. You know, it really was going from being a technological novelty that people went to Nickelodeons to kind of enjoy solo into this big public experience with beautiful movie palaces being constructed and, you know, Hollywood starting to grow up into its own industry. And he was really a part of all that and in some ways a driving force of some of that.
Okay, so back to 1917, and in fact, let's go to March. As you write, it's a great story here. This is a few months after Buster and his mother, Myra, abandon Joe in Los Angeles. They're in New York. Buster goes into this restaurant, and I like this little section about the restaurant, by the way, in the book. It's great. He orders a stack of pancakes, and his life sort of changes. You want to set this up for us? Talk about this.
Yeah, the pancake story. I mean, I feel like that's kind of the crux of this book. Like, if you like the pancake chapter, you'll like the book, because that's probably the biggest digression I go on. But it is a short chapter. But it just so happens that this story that he told many times in many interviews about the day he met Roscoe Arbuckle and the day he entered movies, basically, had this little detail in one telling of the story, which was his telling to his first biographer, Rudy Blesch, where he said, "Oh, yes, you know, on this morning in March, I went into Child's," which was a restaurant chain at the time, and ordered a stack of pancakes. And then he talks about thinking about the solo act that he was trying to create, right? Because after he broke up the family act, he almost immediately, he had no trouble getting an agent in New York and signing with this show called The Passing Show. That was a yearly stage show that was a review. It was sort of like the Ziegfeld Follies, a competitor, in fact, to the Ziegfeld Follies. And he was supposed to develop a solo act for this show, which he, of course, had never done. His whole life, he had been performing with his father and had this, and his mother as well, and had people to interact with on stage. So he had to figure out, how am I going to be a single, as they called it in vaudeville lingo, a single act? And that was sort of what he went into Child's to think about. But as it turned out that day, he didn't really need to develop a solo act, because on his way out of the pancake house, he runs into somebody who he doesn't name in his storytelling, but who seems to have been Lou Anger, an old vaudeville friend of his, now working with Roscoe Arbuckle in film. And Lou Anger says, "Hey, have you ever seen a film being shot?" Keaton says, "No." And so it was either that day or the next day. It's not quite clear, depending on the telling. Anger takes him to Arbuckle's studio in New York. Mm. And they're in the midst of making their very first movie, because Arbuckle had just gotten his own studio after becoming a big star at Keystone. And the movie's called The Butcher Boy. And Keaton ends up playing a couple scenes in it, a very funny scene involving molasses being poured into his hat with Roscoe Arbuckle, a couple of great falls. He doesn't have a big part in Butcher Boy, but he really stands out in it. And he and Roscoe immediately bonded. Mm. They were not quite of the same generation. Roscoe was 7 years older, but they had somewhat similar backgrounds in a way, having been performing since children. Roscoe much less successfully and on smaller circuits, but, you know, really a self-made comedian as well. Yeah. And they almost instantly became good friends and co-directors. And as Keaton says, within, you know, just a few films of working with Arbuckle, within probably a month or so, he was basically the co-director and was coming up with just as many ideas.
They I think you've put it this way before, they vibed pretty well. They had something, there was some, what was it about their chemistry, the two of them?
There's a whole chapter in the book about that's named after Kamiki, the company that they worked in together before Keaton went into independent production. And it really is just about their bond and their chemistry on screen, which you can see in several of those Keaton-Arbuckle collaborations. And something that's fun about those is that Keaton was sort of between personas. He'd left behind his stage persona. He was still inventing his film persona. And he was a kind of a second banana. So he had the freedom to to experiment a bit with his persona. So in the Arbuckle shorts, you can see him crying. You can see him laughing. You know, you see him in all kinds of more expressive modes than you would usually see him in. And you also just get to see him sort of reacting and inventing in the background because he's not necessarily the focus of attention. You know, there might be a group scene with some sort of group fight going on and you can sort of see what inventions he's doing. So maybe you get a little bit of a sense of what it was like to see him on stage along with what was to come in his film career.
Well, as you put it in the book, that kind of respite from when he was the central figure, when he was working with Roscoe, gave him a chance, you say, to simply be on screen in ways he never could in his own films, where, as you put it, his body, always in motion, often in peril, was always at the crux of the action. So it seems like the moment, that sort of break from having to be the center of everything, gave him a chance to develop, I don't know what, a kind of depth of character in some way?
Right. I mean, it let him be sort of an actor, right? Which he didn't necessarily get to do that much in his own films. Of course, he was acting, but I mean, he was being his character. I mean, in the same way that Daffy Duck is always Daffy Duck or Mickey Mouse is always Mickey Mouse, right? I mean, that happened with the silent comics. Chaplin had the tramp and Harold Lloyd had the glasses character and Harry Langdon had this kind of innocent baby character that he played. And Keaton had that poker faced, you know, the guy who's always at the center of the action, but is strangely impassive in his reaction to it. So seeing the moment before that happens, it's great to see the comic invention that goes on. And I write at length about my favorite scene between Keaton and Arbuckle on film, which is from their movie Goodnight Nurse. And the conceit of this scene is that Roscoe's character has just changed into drag, dressed as a nurse to try to escape from this drunk tank where he's been sent. Yeah. Keaton is a doctor who's supposed to be taking care of him, but of course does not recognize that his patient has now transformed into the fetching Miss Fatty, as that character used to be called when he went in drag. And they just flirt. They just improv in a hallway. They're flirting together. It's incredibly silly. You see Keaton almost crack up and have to turn his face away toward the wall because he doesn't want to be caught laughing on screen and break character. And you really see that almost SNL level of kind of, you know, riffing energy between them. And it's really a delight to watch.
Was he a good actor? I guess the question is, when talking came into the picture, was he good at it? Or did he always need the sight gags? I mean, were they crutches? Or was, you know, as you said before, I mean, when he was in vaudeville, he would deliver lines. It wasn't new to him. But I just wondered, was he good at the acting part outside of the physicality part, I guess?
I mean, I would say that he never, after sound came in, not never, but in film anyway, in the early talkies that he did, he never got a chance to prove himself as an actor because he was working with terrible scripts that didn't understand his character at all, you know, and that forced him to say lines that he would never say. I mean, he was not a verbal comedian, that's true. His main interest was not in word comedy, but in physical comedy. But that said, he could certainly deliver a line. He had a good voice. His voice even went with his persona. His voice has been wonderfully described by the silent film historian Kevin Brownlow as being, and this is a quote from Brownlow, like an anchor chain running out. You know, that it has this kind of rusty, kind of Midwestern quality. It went with a certain kind of character for sure. Somebody who's down to earth, somebody who's, you know, a little bit, maybe a little bit slow on the uptake, but not dumb, you know, and MGM's teams of screenwriters never understood that. And so they created this character named Elmer, who I write about in the book. Almost every one of the characters Keaton played in these early talkies at MGM was named Elmer. That was the persona they tried to invent for him. And Elmer was just this rube. He never got the girl. He never seemed to quite understand what was going on in the main plot of the movie. And that quality that we were talking about that in Keaton's silence registers as a kind of passivity or blankness became almost, you know, backwardness and stupidity. It really did not go at all with the dignity of Keaton's persona as we see it in silent film. So I'm not going to judge his acting by those movies, but later on in his life, for example, in the 1950s, when he broke into TV, he got some real acting roles and he was quite wonderful in them. I write about a movie called The Awakening, a TV movie that he made in, I think it was 1954. And it was based on a Nikolai Gogol short story, The Overcoat. And it was a sort of absurdist parable about a guy in a totalitarian society who saves up for a special overcoat and then his overcoat gets stolen. And it was not at all the kind of thing he had ever played. It was a completely straight dramatic role. And it was also kind of a social satire. And it was a drama filmed for television. It was not any kind of genre he'd ever worked in before. And he's on screen almost every moment. And he's wonderful. I mean, I think he had too much of a an understanding of the human condition to not be a great actor. But it was hard after the sound era, especially for a while, for him to find the right vehicles and for people to understand how his persona should be placed.
Dana Stevens, her new book is Cameraman: Buster Keaton, the Dawn of Cinema, and the Invention of the 20th Century. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Here's an easy way to boost the impact of your monthly gift to KUER. Switch to a direct donation from your bank account. When you do, you'll offset steep processing fees and administrative costs associated with keeping credit and debit cards current. But more importantly, you'll give increased funding to the essential news and stories you depend on. Make the switch today at KUER.org/membership.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Dana Stevens. She's the film critic for Slate. She also co-hosts her podcast, Culture Gabfest. We're discussing her new book about Buster Keaton. It's called Cameraman. Dana, I want to ask you about this moment you write about in 1952 when Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton worked together really for the only time. And it's such an interesting time in their lives. You mention how Keaton is really heading into a late life comeback. He's gone through this sort of decline, but he's headed back. Chaplin, on the other hand, is kind of heading into the final chapter of his life, and to, as you describe it, exile and artistic decline. But they work together in this film, Limelight. Talk about this moment.
Yeah, Limelight became this object of fascination for me where I don't really like that movie. It's an incredibly ambitious but failed work of art from Chaplin. You know, you see what he's trying to do and how he's trying to put his whole life's experience, including his experience on the stage and his childhood in London, and pour it all into this semi-autobiographical drama about a comedian, a clown trying to make a comeback. You see all of that happening, and yet it doesn't quite work. There's something about that movie that's just too maudlin. And yet, I felt that I wanted to write about it because not only is it, as you say, the one moment that Keaton and Chaplin work together, but it's this odd crisscrossing of their careers where Keaton is just starting to be revived as a TV star and as a star in the European circus, which we can talk about maybe, and find all kinds of interesting new career opportunities in the early 50s. Chaplin, on the other hand, for the past decade or so, has made only a couple of movies. He starts to make movies at a very slow trickle. Some of his movies are big disappointments to his audience because they're so un-Chaplin-esque. Yeah. So The Tramp is gone, and he makes Monsieur Verdoux, which is a movie that some critics at the time thought was the most brilliant thing he'd ever done, but that was most critics thought was awful. It's a very dark and nihilistic movie about a serial wife murderer who Chaplin plays. It's full of social satire and social critique, and it's also a cruel and cold film about a cruel and cold character that turned a lot of audiences off. So when Limelight comes along in the early 50s, Chaplin is trying to endear himself to his audience again, and that really is what the movie Limelight is all about, about a clown trying to make a comeback. So you have what's happening in the film paralleling to some degree what's happening in Chaplin's life. And you also have what's happening off screen to Chaplin, which is that during the McCarthy era, because he was, in fact, you know, unlike many victims of the House Un-American Activities Committee, he actually was sympathetic to the communist side and, you know, had some involvement in the past. I don't think he was a member of the party, but was certainly sympathetic with those movements. So he was being pretty mercilessly persecuted by the government, by the House Un-American Activities Committee, who was always trying to get him to come and testify, even though they had really nothing against him. And so Limelight turned out unexpectedly to be his last American film. And very shortly after that movie was released, in fact, when he was on a ship on the way to London to host the premiere of Limelight, he finds that he has been not banned from the U.S., but told that in order to re-enter the U.S., he's going to have to take some kind of citizenship quiz, which was clearly, you know, something intended to scare him and humiliate him, something that he probably could easily have passed and gotten back into the U.S., but that really made him so furious he never wanted to return. And so as a result, Chaplin exiled himself to Switzerland, where he would spend the rest of his life with his wife, Una O'Neill, and have 8 children with her and live out the rest of his life, make 2 more movies in Europe that were huge flops, but never return to the United States to make a movie again, and only set foot in the United States one more time to accept an honorary Oscar in 1976. So even though they couldn't have known it when they were making Limelight together, it was really the moment that their, you know, sort of their career trajectories were crisscrossing in a way.
There was one part of that sort of collaboration that I found interesting. You mentioned, you know, Chaplin could be this notorious micromanaging director, but he didn't have to overdo it in his scenes with Keaton. You said that somebody mentioned, you quote, somebody said that Keaton and Chaplin almost had a kind of shorthand. They just sort of did it. I like trying to imagine those two, you know, old veteran pros making improvising scenes together.
Right. Yeah. In fact, the person who made that observation was Norman Lloyd, who just died this year in 2021. The character actor who, you know, he's been in Hitchcock. He's done all kinds of incredible work. And one of the things that he said about being in the audience when Keaton and Chaplin were improvising their scene together, which is a scene on a stage, so the cast and crew were actually sitting in the audience watching them, was one of the great moments of his life as a performer. So there must have been some special things happening on that stage. And one of the things that I write about is that arguably, not all of those things made it into the final cut in the movie. And when you watch their scene together in Limelight, while it's very funny and is full of great bits of comedy business, there's something about the way it's directed that has always frustrated me, because you almost never see both of them in the frame at the same time. You always get the sense that there's some gag happening off screen that you're not seeing. And some other people who were present in the audience on those days, it was over a course of a week or so, I think, that scene was filmed, said that some of the best gags were cut and thought that, you know, Chaplin was sort of trying to hog the stage. Others contested that and said, no, the best things all made it into the movie. But I always feel watching Limelight like there was this one moment that these two great clowns were together on stage. And as you say, Chaplin stopped his micromanagement for once and didn't give line readings and act things out for people as he did in general for his actors, sometimes driving them crazy by doing it. But they really invented something together. And there is something about the way that scene is filmed that doesn't organically capture that moment in the way you'd want to see it captured.
Well, I was watching that scene just this morning, and it's like Chaplin, like there's this moment, for example, when Chaplin's character is taken off stage after he falls into the orchestra pit and he gets stuck in a bass drum. And Keaton's character, even though he's supposed to be this lifelong, you know, partner of his, isn't shown backstage attending to him like everyone else is. It doesn't show that he's worried about him. He's just sort of in the background when Chaplin's character goes back. I don't know. It just seemed to – I couldn't tell what that meant either. And it made me wonder, was Chaplin jealous, or like, why did he, you asked this question, why did he frame it that way? Why did he cut it that way?
Yeah, it's very unusual, even within the conceit of that scene, which is that it's two old clowns making their stage debut again, right? And after this one night gala performance, wouldn't Keaton's character be in the curtain call, right? I mean, the original curtain call would have called for him to at least be standing there, even if he was standing there sort of in shock that his partner had just fallen off the stage. So it doesn't even make sense within the story. And there's something very odd about it. It's hard not to speculate that there might have been some kind of professional jealousy, but there's no evidence that there was. It seems more likely to me, and it seems more consistent with the character of Chaplin as he emerges in his autobiography and in stories about this, they're working together, that he just wasn't focused on Keaton. You know, I mean, he never mentions him in his autobiography. Yeah. And Chaplin's autobiography is 500 plus pages long. He name drops constantly. And Keaton is someone who never comes up. He's not in the index. He's never named. I just don't think he was really on the radar, especially for Chaplin.
So the question of how Buster Keaton comes to see his time in film, like at MGM, for example, at this point in the book, you write about how he gets this new life, Buster Keaton does, in television. He loves TV. He loves to watch TV, spends tons of time watching television. He gets to be on television. He, for a brief moment, has his own television show. He does commercials. He does cameos. He does spots in variety shows. But I wonder how he sees his time in film. There's this moment you mention at MGM, the question of where he fit in those days when television is becoming emergent, film is losing ground. And you write about this short promotional film for the 25th anniversary of MGM that seemed to kind of convey where Buster Keaton thought he fit or where he did fit and how out of place he kind of was. Do you want to mention that moment?
Yeah, I'm so glad that you pinpointed that because I almost cut that from the book. There was this moment that I thought, I'm going too far down some sort of eddy here about something that's completely unrelated to the story. But I was just so fascinated by that little promotional film, which MGM made about a luncheon, a luncheon for the stars that was supposed to celebrate their 25th anniversary. And Louis B. Mayer appears to make a speech at it. It was probably something that showed internally at MGM and maybe showed before their films as a kind of, you know, warm up. Mm. And the big centerpiece of this short is this slow pan across all these long tables full of stars, some of them in costume. And it's you know, it's kind of gawking. You're seeing, you know, Judy Garland talking to Fred Astaire, and you're seeing, I can't remember who else you see in there, Jimmy Durante and Clark Gable.
Spencer Tracy.
Laughing together. Yeah. Spencer Tracy. And it's sort of fun to try to spot and identify people as you go along. Some of them are still in costume from whatever movie they were shooting that day of the luncheon. But then there's this moment that the camera pans along and captures the end of a table that Keaton's at. And the place that he's sitting, just for one thing, seemed oddly symbolic to me, although I later learned that they seated the stars in alphabetical order on that day so as not to appear hierarchical. So he's seated next to Claude Jarman, who was a juvenile actor, actually, interestingly, given that Buster started as a kid actor. But he was a little boy in The Yearling, who was a kind of a discovery, and wow, who at this point was maybe 14 or so. So Claude Jarman is on Keaton's right, and on his left is Lassie, yeah, the dog star, who has her own little table, and she's eating from her own little bowl of food. That actually works out alphabetically. It's JKL,
right.
But it also seems like a kind of joke about what Keaton was at the studio, right? That he was always a sort of mascot, and the seating almost seems to underline that. And then, and this is the moment I think maybe you're talking about, as the camera passes by him, Keaton, who is always aware of where a camera was, he's always directing, even when he's not behind the camera, does this tiny little bit of improvised business with a stick of celery on his plate. And you have to see it to sort of get why it's funny. It's just a fraction of a second long. But it's a moment that really struck me because at that moment in the late 40s, his position at MGM was really that of a workman behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. You know, he wasn't appearing in films anymore. He was a gag writer with his own office in the writer's building. He was a useful and important gag writer and, you know, who provided an important service. But he wasn't a performer anymore. And so that tiny little performance moment just says to me so much about his life as a performer, his relationship to the company that had been keeping him alive at that point for, you know, over a decade, but that he was about to leave, and to what it was like, you know, to work for a big corporate company like MGM when you're somebody who's trying to do something different and you can't find your slot.
Mm. You mentioned how in the mid-1950s, this was a time of loss and change and reinvention. But there's this moment when he's in the circus for a while in France. Would just say something about this moment. This took me by surprise.
Yeah, this was really, really fun to research. And it was another rabbit hole that I loved going down. It also included interviewing a clown who was 9 years old when he saw Buster Keaton perform in 1954. And wow, it changed his life. It's what made him become a clown, wow, and a clown teacher. And it's an extraordinary story. But yeah, there was a period of 3 years, not consecutive years, but in the late 40s and early 50s, you know, as he was reemerging and getting TV jobs, et cetera, Keaton took this job, a seasonal job, where he went to the Cirque Medrano, this historical circus in Paris, and was their headliner. He was the main clown at the Medrano Circus, which was a very clown-centric circus. That was sort of their big thing, is that the great clowns of the world would perform at the Medrano. But Keaton fit into that world perfectly. I mean, it called on his vaudeville experience from childhood and the improv that he loved to do and the way he loved to work live audiences, you know, something he was really good at doing. And it also just gave him complete creative freedom. So for each of those years at the Medrano, he would design a different act. And apparently he was such a hit that the other clowns, you know, there was sort of a pack of clowns that helped him and played bit roles. But the clowns who weren't on stage would all gather at the entrances to watch him because he was sort of such a legendary performer.
Dana, finally, you mentioned this question that sort of hangs over the years, the later years of Keaton's life. You know, the question of whether he was disappointed in his career. Impossible to answer in some ways, and as you say, kind of beside the point. But what do you make of that question?
Yeah, it's a question that is unanswerable in the way, and I say this in the book, in the way that was he an abused child kind of hangs over his childhood. Mm. You know, I mean, it's a thing that you could ponder endlessly, but it sort of depends on, well, what do you mean by abused and what do you mean by disappointed in his career? He would have denied both of those things and in fact did in interviews always sort of say, I consider myself the luckiest and happiest of performers. And I think that's part of his general taciturn personality and his general resilience. He was not going to present it in a way that made it sound as if he was disappointed. But it is hard to imagine that somebody who had the creative peak and the creative power and independence that he did for such a long stretch of his life as a performer, you know, if you begin at age 5 and go through about age at 35. It does seem impossible to imagine that he was not sometimes disappointed, that he never got to direct another film, for example. You know, he got to perform plenty, but he never really headlined a film again. And that although he found plenty of success and plenty of work, you know, he never had that kind of creative freedom that he lost at the 3-2-1. He never again found that creative freedom that he had lost around 1927.
You're right about this question he asked on his last day. He says this to a hospital aide. He was diagnosed with lung cancer, though Eleanor never told him he had lung cancer, which is probably a story in of itself, but he dies at the end of 3 months that the doctors gave him to live. And he says this thing to, I guess it's a hospital aide at one point. He says, "Why don't I just give up? Why don't I?"
Mm-hmm.
Which you write about kind of was mostly unthinkable for Keaton as a character and as a person all his life, I guess.
Yeah. And even the way it's phrased, "Why don't I just give up?"
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's almost as if he himself is trying to understand his resilience. You know, I mean, it's a very painful thing to write about somebody's last, not quite last words, but, you know, something that they repeated on their last day of life. But it seemed, again, like it was this kind of poetic condensation of the question that everybody had been asking all of his life, right? I mean, everybody who watched his act as a child would sort of say, how did he survive? Mm. How did he do it, right? Why is he still smiling? Or why is he still poker-faced? Why has he not been hurt? And as I say somewhere else, I mean, when he was really little and was performing, audience would say, he's too young to go through that much suffering and that much, you know, violence. And then when he was really old and he was in his 60s and doing all kinds of crazy stunts, people were saying, he's too old to be going through all that. You know, so his whole life, it was as if he were, you know, this indestructible force, but whose humor came from people saying, why is he not being destroyed? You know, so on the very last day of his life, for him to be asking that question over and over as if he can't answer it was just somehow so moving to me.
Dana Stevens. She's the film critic for Slate, also co-host of the podcast Culture Gabfest. Her book is Cameraman, Buster Keaton, The Dawn of Cinema, and the Invention of the 20th Century. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. The program is produced by Kerry Watson, Benjamin Bombard, and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.